This is Daryl and Jeff. We like movies and music. Some people would even call us buffs, but we wouldn't go that far. First we'll talk about a movie, and later on we'll talk about a record. Sometimes we fight, but usually we don't fight too bad. Mostly we stay friends.
Hey everybody, you're listening to 10 Things I Hate About You 2. That was Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds with Red Right Hand. That is segueing our movie, which is Scream. We've got a guest, Trevor Murphy, here today.
Woo, that's me.
That's Trevor Murphy. And we've got Jeffrey Lawton as well.
As always.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I didn't even do anything.
No, you really didn't. That was me. That's me being aggressive too soon.
You're sick today.
I am sick today, but this was an unmissable show because we spent all the time. We watched Scream.
We spent all the time.
We spent all the time watching a two-hour movie with Trevor that I couldn't bail on him.
Plus Halloween, right?
Plus Halloween.
It's kind of themey.
You can't not do a radio show before Halloween.
I'm not going to explain why that joke doesn't work and works in Jeff's way. Let's just move along. We did Scream. This is one of Trevor's favorite movies, right?
It is my favorite movie.
Actual favorite movie.
100%, hands down. If somebody asks me what my favorite movie is, this is the answer I will give them.
Well, why don't we start with that? Why?
Well, it's kind of a weird beast. We'll preface this entire conversation by saying I know nothing about horror movies. I actually don't like watching horror movies.
Me neither.
And I've learned pretty much everything I know about the horror classics from this movie.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Like all the plot, the major plot points.
You should do the plot synopsis then.
Oh, yeah. We usually do a plot synopsis. Why don't you do it?
Okay. So, the plot synopsis of this movie revolves around Sidney Prescott, who is a young Neve Campbell, teenaged, not in real life, but in the movie. She's
my favorite version of Neve Campbell.
Yeah. The scenario is that the movie opens up and two people get murdered, and this touches home very close to her because her mother has recently been murdered approximately a year from the point where these murders happen. And then the rest of the movie shapes up to be like a whodunit kind of thing, and then we discover who did it at the end.
There's
no spoiler.
There's no spoiler alert. So the killer ends up being her boyfriend and his best friend.
Yeah, Matthew Lillard and
Skeet Ulrich.
The two most obvious people.
Yeah.
Yes, but what I like so much about the movie is that they really do that whole thing where they kind of try and use misdirection to try and, because they arrest Billy very early on. They also give you very obvious clues, if you know who the killers are in the movie, that you can kind of pick it out. But if it's your first time watching, they kind of make you think that it's not them. They lead you in a whole bunch of other directions until that final climactic.
Yeah, there's a lot of
moment.
False plants. One of my favorite false plants, which maybe we should talk about, is Henry Winkler as the principal. Yeah. Most inappropriate principal of all time.
Terribly inappropriate.
Throat touch.
He touches Sidney Prescott's face in a very gentle way. And then two kids like get the masks of the killers and run around the high school trying to scare people. And he threatens them with scissors, right, while cutting the masks up in front
they
of their
like
faces.
Shears.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they're like the biggest scissors. Like, why would a principal have those in his office?
And
I don't
know.
And
they make sword sounds when he waves them around.
I love the sound effects in this movie, though. I will say that. I love the every time the killer breaks out the knife, it's just like, shing. And you get that really weird reverb situation going on. It's fun.
This movie's terrifying.
Okay, let's start with that. I think this movie, so this is the first scary movie I watched in the theater as a kid. I think I was 13 when this came out. It terrified me at the time. But in retrospect, it's not very scary at all.
No, it's gory. It's definitely gory.
Yeah.
The suspense elements are there, which, you know, is part of any good horror movie, I would assume. But what the scariest part, and this is kind of where my love for this movie comes in, is that it's the beginning scene. That's the worst part.
It is the worst part.
It is the absolute worst part. It's the absolute goriest part of the whole show. And in compared to movies that are out now, it's not gory at all, really.
When you just see someone like get stabbed in the chest, like, have you guys seen Zodiac?
No.
There's like a horrifying stabbing scene in Zodiac. When Drew Barrymore just gets stabbed and you just watch that person and you see her chest and you watch them put a knife through her heart, mm-hmm. it's like the worst thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, the beginning's pretty gory, pretty scary. Jeff was super scared. He had his eyes half shut. He was squinting and trying to not look.
But then I felt better about it after.
Yeah.
Yeah, it calms down.
They alleviate it with a lot of comedy, too, which is another reason I love this movie.
A lot of comedy, a lot of references. So we
the
came
comedic
up
with genius of Jamie Kennedy.
Let's talk about this real quick. Is this movie a pastiche, an homage, or a parody? We've had a bit of conversation about that. So what do you guys think? Should we define those words or just rip in
there?
It's
not a parody because
it's definitely
they're sincere.
Not a parody. Yeah.
It's more sincere than
but
a parody.
It's not making fun of horror movies. It's kind of examining the horror movie tropes and turning them on their head. So it's like a critique of classic horror movie scenarios.
What other movie would you compare this to that's done a similar thing, like is referential in its treatment of a genre? Is there any other movie that comes readily to mind?
I mean, not for me.
Jeff,
I don't know that much about movies, though.
Talk about other stuff and I'll come back to
Jeff's
it.
Going to come back with an answer. Let's talk about the careers of the people in the movie.
Clerks.
Clerks. Is your example? What's that a critique
also shown in the movie on top of the VCR when they're watching.
There's just meta about movies and they always talk about movies. And
I'm thinking more, though, like of a movie that is within a genre that is like playing
like
with
self-examining
the tropes of the genre.
I feel like there's a recent rom-com that's...
Yeah, that...
Not the Paul Rudd one.
Not the Paul Rudd one, because that is one.
Isn't like Crazy Stupid Love kind of like that?
I don't know. I haven't seen... I've only seen one. But the
Did
Paul Rudd
watch.
Rom-com is a good example. The one that... Is it David Wayan? The guy from Stella? Is that his name? Either way, who cares? Mm. The guy who did
David
Wet Hot
Wayne.
David
yeah.
Wayne did Wet Hot American Summer.
Okay. I thought you were saying Damon Wayne wrong.
No.
totally different.
I am
movie.
Dumb enough to do that, but I wasn't doing that this time.
Keeney Iva Wayne.
Let's talk about everyone's careers. Who do you feel like had the best post Scream career?
Liev Schreiber.
Yeah, I guess Liev Schreiber's the answer.
Well, he's still going strong.
What's he in besides? I know him from Defiance.
He's in Goon. He's in
He's
in that Ang Lee Woodstock movie.
Okay.
Let's not forget Scream 2 and 3.
You know who I'm going to make the argument for in this movie that is kind of my favorite in the movie? Is Lillard. I think
Lillard.
Still...
His best movie was before this movie. Sorry.
SLC Punk.
Yeah.
I
don't know.
And that movie's not good.
I mean, you have to think about it this way. This movie came out in 1996, 2 years into the Friends career.
Yeah.
So Courtney Cox... post-Scream and during Scream trilogy still has, you know, 8 years of Friends ahead of her. So she's definitely probably the most successful.
Winkler was in a top three television show of all time.
There you go.
Yep.
Yeah, but that was before.
No,
or are you talking about a new one?
Arrested Development.
Oh, right. Yeah, you're right.
No, Happy Days is a top three television show of all time.
I don't know.
I should have clicked.
Good, totally. And also, I mean, let's not forget that David Arquette was the WCW champion.
True.
I just want to throw that out.
David Arquette was a wrestler?
Well, he was a wrestler for a very brief moment.
Remember Ready to Rumble?
Yes. Well, that's why he was a wrestler. It was a promo opportunity for his movie that was about pro wrestling. And as such, WCW brought him into the fold and actually made him a champion. And it's one of the things that if you know anything about WCW or professional wrestling or are interested in the histories, it's one of the things that people talk about as being one of the things that collapsed WCW.
Yeah.
Like, they were like, no coming back from this. We're gone. We're done.
I like to think of David Arquette as the thinking man's Luke Wilson.
Here's a, I don't know how much of the research that you've done. I mean, I clearly am steeped in this movie, but he was supposed to die. He was not supposed to be in the sequels. David Arquette's character, Dewey, was in the very last scene. They decided to save him because his crowd response in the test showings was very high.
Yeah, he's super likable. He's one of the most likable guys in the whole movie.
And so they wanted to make sure he was around for the sequel. So that's why, you know, there's the scene where he comes out of the house. He's clearly been stabbed in the back.
Yeah, in the back, the knife sticking out of his back.
And then he falls, and later on we see him still unconscious outside on the porch when Skeet Ulrich shoots Courtney Cox. And then you see him only again.
She doesn't get shot.
He kicks her.
That's right. He knocks her out. Yeah. But you only see him again in that final scene where, like, all the cops and stuff show up. You see him getting in the ambulance. But he was not supposed to be alive at the end of the original screenplay.
Interesting. Who do you think fell hardest? Nev? Is Nev's career
gone? Well, she was the star of the movie, so she has the farthest to fall from.
Yeah.
Nev is always I think her career in general is kind of weird anyway. Yeah. I think it's hard to kind of put her up against someone like Courtney Cox or David Arquette. She was never, although she had Party of Five, she was never really
on their level.
I mean, like, major motion pictures, these are the best ones, and all the dudes will say Wild Things, right?
Oh, right. I forgot about Wild Things.
Can't believe you forgot about Wild Things.
She's in a movie called The Company.
Maybe we should play a clip. And I want to go back to what we were talking about before and play one of the clips of the scariest part of the whole movie. So there's two clips. One of them is like the earlier part of the phone call where it's just starting to get creepy. And then part two is like the terrifying part of the phone call. So I'll let you guys decide which one you want to play.
Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
No, I mean, no, Drew. It's the Drew Barrymore phone call, but it's the earlier part when
she's
it's more
the best
playful.
But
career.
She's the best. Yes. Oh. Yes. But we'll talk about this after this.
Do you want the playful part or the scary part?
I think you should play the scary part.
Okay.
The scary part. No.
It's more appropriate for the overall essence of the film.
Jeff,
you're not gonna see her get stabbed.
You're just gonna have to get over it. Okay, so this is the scary clip from the movie when there's a couple bad words in it, so preface that. It's about 2 minutes long. And he gets really aggressive with her on the phone. And
it's kind of when she figures out that this is no longer... at the beginning of the movie, she thinks it's kind of just like a prank call, and she's like kind of flirtatious with him and trying to kind of see where the conversation goes, oddly enough, although she has a boyfriend, Steve. She plays along, and...
What's the significance of the Jiffy Pop?
It's
just that it catches on fire.
Yeah, it kind of it gives the smoke for the...
Yeah,
it
gave him an excuse to put a smoke machine all through the scene.
It's an aesthetic thing.
No reference at all?
No.
Not that I know of. All right, here is... Maybe you know. Here's the scary part of the initial phone call with Drew Barrymore from Scream. Oh, whoops. I got it on the wrong thing. I'm cool. I got it.
Right. Steve lives.
Please don't do that.
Come on. It'll be fun.
Please.
It's an easy category.
Please.
Movie trivia. I'll even give you a warm-up question.
Don't do this, I can't.
Name the killer in Halloween.
No.
Come on, it's your favorite scary movie, remember? He had a white mask, he stalked the babysitters.
No.
Come on, yes you
no.
do.
Please.
What's his name?
I can't.
Steve's counting on you.
Michael. Michael Myers.
Yes! Very good. Now for the real question.
No!
But you're doing so well. We can't stop now.
Stop, leave us alone.
Then answer the question. Same category.
Oh, please stop.
Name the killer in Friday the 13th.
Jason! Jason! Jason!
I'm sorry. That's the wrong answer.
No, it's not. No, it's not. It was Jason.
Afraid not. No way.
Listen, it was Jason. I saw that movie 20 goddamn times!
Then you should know Jason's mother, Mrs. Voorhees, was the original killer. Jason didn't show up until the sequel. I'm afraid that was a wrong answer.
You tricked me.
Lucky for you, there's a bonus round. But poor Steve, I'm afraid he's out.
So then they disembowel Steve.
Of course, not Paul Walker, by the way.
Yeah, Jeff was like, is that Paul Walker? I think that's Paul Walker. It looks a lot like Paul Walker.
Yeah, that's all normal things to say.
Yeah, you got his guts cut out, though.
Yeah, Steve doesn't bode well. So that part's terrifying. That part terrified me as a kid. I couldn't sleep for like 3 nights after this movie.
So here are some of the things that make this movie so culturally relevant. Number one is the fact that leading into the movie, Drew Barrymore, who appears and dies in the first scene, was on all the posters. Like, they were promoting her as the big star. Like, she was the star of the movie. And then when people got to the movie and she died in the first scene, it was, like, unheard of.
Anything can happen.
Other movies that happen like that keep going. The one I'm thinking of is the one with Steven Seagal. The plane one where he dies right away. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Not at all. I'm not off of my Steve Seagal filmography.
That's a really, like, he was like billed as like the top guy. It was like this action movie. I think it's maybe Air Force One.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But maybe it's not. It's one of those type movies. Mm. Oh, well, keep going.
I don't know. I don't know. That's here is my...
Other cultural things, though.
The other cultural things. This is also in the dawning of the cell phone era.
Correct.
And, you know, from what I understand about horror movies and the horror genre is that it's typically kind of social criticism about things that are happening. So, for example, zombie movies are typically in a time when the economy is terrible and everything sucks, for example. So they use the cell phone as like the fear driving factor. Like, it's this new technology that is going to ruin everything. And that's kind of the cultural thing that they're playing on with this movie in 1996.
But cell phones are going to ruin everything?
Well, I mean, it's 1996. Cell phones. The cell phones they use in this movie are not ridiculously big, but they're certainly not the kind of phones we use now.
Yeah.
They also make every kid in this movie a big dink.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. They really do. The kids in this movie are just like the worst.
No likable character.
The worst of humans.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot going on in this movie where I think it's a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, TPS, where he dies right away, not Steven Seagal. Maybe we can figure that out. Either way, there's a lot of like generational critique where these are the worst kids. They're running around. They have no sympathy for anyone who's died. They like run around making pranks all the time. Winkler is very disturbed by the generation of kids that he's bringing up at this school.
I think this too, though, is a play on that like movies created by older people often will put that slant on the generation. And I don't think that they're saying like, I don't think with this movie they're saying kids are ass, you know, they're idiots. I think they're just saying everybody thinks this is how like a horror movie is supposed to be, so we're going to make them the worst.
Yeah.
You know, like they're playing it up. It's not like they're not agreeing with the statement. They're using that as a way into the movie, I think.
A referential piece.
Yeah.
Or like a way, yeah, to critique the horror movie genre or play with it.
Right.
Generally.
Because you know, you do have those kids that you're talking about, and they're not necessarily the stars of the movie, and the people who aren't the worst people are the people who survive, the people who kind of figure out what's going on, the people who understand the scenario, like Nev.
Can I take us into the plot components quickly and ask a few questions to our resident expert? So Skeet Ulrich and Stu, played by Matthew Lillard, are the killers.
Yes.
They kill, the first killing they do is
Casey and Steve. Well,
no, is
Drew Barrymore.
Is Drew? No, not Drew Barrymore.
It's Maureen Prescott. It's a year ago. It's
and they
Sydney's
killed
mom.
Her because she was having sex with Skeet's dad, and that's why his family split up, according to him. So
mommy
issues. He needs to kill her.
Wait, why did they do that? Because at first they said, "Oh, it's scarier when there is no motive," and they should have left it at that.
I agree with you. It's a little weird because he goes on and explains
the motive.
Stu has no motive.
But okay, and then they kill Casey and Steve.
Peer pressure is the motive.
Why do they kill Casey and Steve?
So, well, because
there's a small allusion to the fact that Stu used to date Casey.
Yeah.
But is that all it is? Like, Stu's jealous and upset, and so he kills them? Or?
The way that they plot it out is as though it's some sort of weird, crazy game for them.
Okay.
Like, it's not, it's a way to kind of create this movie that they have in their head. And he comes to that realization, or you come to that realization with him when they're in that scene in the bedroom where they eventually sleep together. And he says, you know, like, life,
everything's
a movie. And so there's kind of the plot being that they're living out this kind of crazy movie and that they're creating the plot for themselves in order to kind of have some fun. That's the kind of psychotic part about all of it.
Okay. So then they kill Casey and Steve. They kill Winkler, you say, because they need the kids to leave the party.
Yeah.
And then who else do they kill?
No, that's just
by the end they're just killing anyone who's around.
Wes Craven needs the kids to leave the party.
Yeah. It's totally. Yeah. This is not the most there are plot holes.
It's not the most airtight plot of all time.
But I still love it.
Should we play, like you talked about, all this referential and that they think they're in a movie? There's a very referential part where Jamie Kennedy's character gets up and talks about the rules of a horror movie and how to survive a horror movie. So maybe we should play that clip.
Yeah.
Come back, talk a little bit more, play one more clip, and then move on to Marilyn Manson.
I could do this for days.
Yeah.
Days.
Days.
All day.
Here comes.
What is all wrong? Why do they do that? It's too red.
Wait, here comes another. Hearing?
Ooh! Yes!
Predictable. I knew he was gonna bite it.
How can you watch this shit over and over?
Shh!
When do we see breasts? I wanna see Jamie Lee's breasts. When do we see Jamie Lee's breasts?
Breasts? Not until Trading Places in 83. Jamie Lee was always the virgin in horror movies. She never showed her tits until she went legit.
Could afford a decent pair.
What'd you say? That's why she always outsmarted the killer in the big chase scene at the end. Only virgins can do that. Don't you know the rules?
What rules?
You don't... Jesus Christ, you don't know the rules?
Have an aneurysm, why don't you?
There are certain rules that one must abide by in order to successfully survive a horror movie. For instance... Number one, you can never have sex. No. Big no-no! Big no-no!
I'm a dead man.
Sex equals death, okay? Number two, you can never drink or do drugs. No, the sin factor. It's a sin. It's an extension of number one. And number three, never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
I'm getting another beer. You want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back.
And then he says, and I'll see you in the knife with a see you in the kitchen with a knife.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
That's a good one.
I
swear to God, I knew every word of this movie when I was a kid.
I believe you probably
quote it.
Still
like, I had to hold back a little bit last night when we were watching it, not going
to
lie.
We watched Speed with Joe, and I had to tell her to stop because for the first like 20 minutes, she was just saying the movie to me. And I was like, I need to watch the movie, Joe. I can't just watch you say the movie at me.
I'm exactly the same with Chariots of Fire.
Have you ever seen Chariots of Fire, actually?
No.
Not even in slow motion?
Have I seen it in slow motion?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I've been in slow motion and while watching it. Okay.
So let's think, is there anything we want to finish up talking about? Jeff, what were your impressions? This was not the first time you'd ever seen it, but you haven't seen this very much, right?
Yeah, well, I was terrified at first, and then not terrified at all towards it. Well, maybe still a little bit terrified, but...
As the critical dude of this group, you're the whiniest about a bad movie. How do you feel about this
thing? I think it's a good movie. I think it's a good popcorn movie.
Yeah.
I think it's a good popcorn movie.
Okay.
It's like, definitely fun.
Sort of like...
It's like...
Love Actually, but horror movie version. Like, it knows its tone, it's doing what it does, and it does it well.
And it's also... It's important to think about the time it came out and what was going on with horror movies at that time, because horror movies were dead.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Yeah. They were just... Every horror movie up until that point was pretty much a joke.
And that's kind of the point that, like, Randy... Like, that's why Randy talks about that stuff in this scene that we just listened to.
About the rules.
Because he's
stuff?
Talking about how, like, played out the genre is, basically. Like, and the guy in on the couch who says, like, it's so predictable. I saw it coming. You know, that's what this movie attempts to buck.
To undermine
in terms of the
and
trend.
Play with.
Yeah.
But then it spawns the thing that it's bucking.
Which is
like a slew of teen slasher flicks.
Yeah, it totally like revived the horror movie genre, which has not died. It's interesting too from a business standpoint now why horror movies are doing so well. Maybe that's why they've
it's
always
died
done
now,
well.
At least in that.
No, form. Man, like those Paranormal Activity, like Sevens and all those movies, like the Handycam movies are like. I guess Blair Witch sort of then reinvented it, but the Handycam horror movie they cost like $1 million to make.
Slasher flicks though.
Slasher flicks.
Well, I guess it's all torture porn now.
Yeah, those ones are less in. It's more like. The Paranormal Activity is up to like 5 or 6.
Yeah.
There's all like those handy cammy kind of ones. But basically, from an industry standpoint, they're cheap to make, and then sometimes they make like 30, 40 million, which is like a 40-fold return on their investment. So it's superhero movies and horror movies, and those are like Hollywood's bread and butter right now.
But this movie was, I mean, even now is kind of single-handedly credited with reviving the genre in the late 90s.
I buy that 100%. And it, even like in terms of what it managed to do, like, from a genre standpoint, like think of all the Final Destination movies.
Yeah.
I Know What You Did Last Summer movies.
Disturbing Behavior.
It created an entire like series of spoof movies.
The
like
Faculty.
There's six scary movies.
Oh, the Faculty.
I don't remember The Faculty.
So here's an interesting tidbit. The original title of this movie was actually Scary Movie.
Really?
Yeah. That was the working title.
Why'd they change it to Scream?
Well, because that
would have seemed cooler.
Well, Scary Movie's kind of stupid.
Yeah.
I think it reveals their hand too much. It tells you out of the gate that this is a movie that's going to talk about movies a lot.
Yeah.
And you kind of don't want to know that. I don't think going in, you just kind of have fun when you're along for the ride.
Now it just says that it's going to be Screams.
Yeah, Screams.
There's going to be Screams.
Jeff knows all about Screams.
What's that mean?
You screamed a couple times, man.
I didn't scream.
You screamed.
Bro.
No.
Get off that.
You just watched with your hands over your eyes. And
one hand.
You did a lot of this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Squinting and just being like...
But it is funny. Like, it is funny. I think there are some funny moments. Matthew Lillard and Jamie Kennedy provide some really great comic relief in this.
I was saying,
even in the like extreme ending where they're doing all the reveal, like Matthew Lillard is hilarious.
Matthew Lillard, I thought was super cool when I was 13 and watching this. I thought it was. I wanted to be Matthew Lillard when I grew up. Like, I thought I could be that goofy, tall, funny guy.
This is the point I want to disagree with you guys on. I don't think it's funny.
You don't think it's funny at all?
No.
When Lillard gets the phone thrown at him and he's like, oh, man.
At all. I mean, I guess there are some funny parts. But I think people think it's more funny than it is because they want to laugh in order to feel the relief from being scared.
Sure. I'll agree with that. And I think that like some of the like all the referential stuff, like, you know, there are rules. Like when I was a kid, I thought that was so cool. And that stuff has like aged slightly less well because there's been so many genre plays up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, this was one of the first ones and it did it really well. But there's a lot of like sort of underhanded, like all the Henry Winkler parts are hilarious. Anytime he's in the movie, it's
super kind of bizarre.
But he's not supposed to be funny, though.
I think he might have been supposed to be funny. And Lillard was
only when he like sees himself in the mirror and stuff.
Yeah, that's really ridiculous. Where he like scares himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Lillard
twice,
was,
by the way, twice he does that in that scene.
And everyone knew Lillard was funny. Like Lillard was meant to be funny.
But he's not funny. He just sticks his tongue out a bunch.
He's funny.
And goes, man.
When he's talking about how his dad's going to be so mad at him and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those parts were
funny. It's his delivery of the lines. I don't think the lines are inherently funny. I think it's the delivery that makes them funny.
Yeah, Lillard did a good job.
One thing I want to say about this movie is that the cameos are some of my favorite parts in this.
Yeah, why don't you talk about those quick? Because you pointed out the Wes Craven one.
Yeah, so
cool.
Wes Craven is in the movie as the janitor in one of the Henry Winkler scenes, and he's dressed as Freddy Krueger.
It's fast enough, too, that unless you really knew it, you wouldn't get it.
But no, totally.
With that weird stripy sweater and stuff.
So like, these are the parts about this movie that I find extremely brilliant. Linda Blair is a reporter early on in the movie, the girl from The Exorcist. So they're kind of like bringing in a lot of this older stuff and again like referencing that stuff in other ways. I also wanted to mention that this movie was written by Kevin Williamson, who is probably best known for writing Dawson's Creek.
Whoa.
We should also say that one of the title actors, Liev Schreiber, plays a cameo in this movie.
One Liev Schreiber.
We should talk about that quickly because you pointed this out at the end that Liev Schreiber, is it Schreiber or Schreiber?
I think it's Schreiber.
Well, Liev Schreiber.
I think it's Liev Schreiber.
Liev Schreiber, who, you want to hear a quick funny story?
Yeah.
I was in New York City
Is that where you're
Watts?
From?
No, I'm from LA.
Okay.
I was in New York City and saw Liev Schreiber and Naomi Watts and their kids just like biking down the middle of the street, just like the wrong way on a one-way street, not giving two hoots about nothing, and just looking really celebrity, really rich. Maybe it's not a funny story, but I've seen Liev Schreiber biking the wrong way down a one-way street.
So for me, if I would have seen that, I would have been like, Cotton Weary, oh my God, it's Cotton Weary.
But he's credited in this movie. He gets a credit. He doesn't have a single speaking line. He's only on a TV
Yeah, like, he doesn't even appear like physically in the movie.
Yeah, he's like in a recorded shot of him like being escorted through prison kind of thing. But Jeff made the point that he probably did have a speaking line that was cut, and part of his contract was that he would be credited.
And so I thought about that after, and I don't know where that would have come in. The only thing I could have thought about was if they showed a scene where Courtney Cox goes to interview him or something.
It probably is.
And maybe, yeah.
Can I, this has nothing to do with the movie, but a different movie, but it's like another example of this happening in a ridiculous way. Adrian Brody was supposed to be the lead character in The Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen The Thin Red Line?
No.
He was supposed to be the lead character. It's a Malick movie, so all of these characters were in it. And he wasn't even notified that he was 100% edited out of the movie.
He wasn't 100%. He's still in the movie, but he's very much not the lead any longer.
But he thought he was the star of the movie. He was cast as the star of the movie, and he was edited down to barely being in the movie and didn't even know that when he showed up to the premiere.
So he showed up to the premiere
thinking that he was going to be the star of the movie, watched the movie, and he was only in it for like a couple
minutes. The guy in A League of Their Own that plays Gina Davis's like husband who's away, who also gets like major billing, who's in the movie for 2.5 minutes?
Bill Pullman.
Yeah, Bill Pullman. And then you like to ask the question, who do you like better, Bill Pullman or Bill Paxton?
Gotta be Pullman.
And I don't know the difference. So we're going to play the final clip that we're going to play before we move on to talk about Mechanical Animals. The
difference is Pax and Pull.
So we're going to play the scene where they sort of, it's after the reveal about why they're doing it. And now they're talking about like sort of
this is how we did it.
Yeah.
They're telling you all the kind of like the plot synopsis here. And they're showing you how they cloned the cell phone, figured out the voice tricks and are framing the dad.
And you get a little bit of Lillard being funny at the end. There's a couple swear words here too. So this is about 2 minutes long. And then we should talk about what Mechanical animal song do you want to come in with? Maybe we should go right from this into that.
Let's start with probably something that's the most well-known. Like, let's do the Dope Show.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So, yeah, moving on. This is the last scene from Scream.
You think about it now, huh? Your daddy's the chief suspect. We cloned his cellular. Evidence is all right there, baby.
What if your father snapped? Your mother's anniversary set him off and he went on a murder spree killing everyone.
Except for Billy and me. We were left for dead.
Then he kills you and shoots himself in the head. Perfect ending.
I thought of that.
Watch this. Ready?
Yeah. Yeah! I'm ready, baby! Hit it! Get up! Yeah, man, get up! Hit it! Good one, man. Jesus. Oh, shit. My turn.
Don't forget, stay to the side and don't go too deep.
Okay. I remember. Fuck! God damn it, Stu!
Sorry, Billy.
I guess I got a little too zealous, huh?
Give me the knife.
Oh.
Give me the knife! Now!
You see, Sid, everybody dies, but us, everybody dies! But us, we gonna carry on and plan the sequel, cause let's face it, baby, these days, you gotta have a sequel.
These sick fucks, you've seen one too many movies.
Nah, Sid, don't you blame the movies. Movies don't create psychos. Movies make psychos more creative.
Stop it, Billy, would you, all right? I can't take anymore. I feel like...
So I think there's kind of an interesting segue out of Scream into this, in the sense that the last thing we heard about Scream was, you know, don't blame the movies. Movies don't make psychopaths.
Movies make psychos more creative.
And I think that the segue is that people wanted to blame Marilyn Manson for a ton of stuff that happened, including Columbine, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of like school shootings and just like disaffected youth that everyone blamed on Marilyn Manson.
So, and still do. Like when that shooting happened in Moncton, that was a topic that was brought up.
Marilyn Manson?
Yeah, I'm not kidding.
Oh my God. And
metal music. And I was like, guys, it's 2014.
Yeah,
come on.
For real. So maybe let's just start. I do not like Marilyn Manson. I never have, never was into it, never liked Beautiful People, never got into anything. Jeff, were you ever into it?
I really liked the Beautiful People.
Okay. And I guess I'm just curious, and I don't mean this pejoratively, but how you got into Marilyn Manson and why he's like your total favorite.
Yeah. Well, you know, they say that the music you listen to when you're 14 years old is kind of the music that defines you for the rest of your life.
Oh no.
And I think that, Jeff has to deal with that.
Yeah. Well, he likes the Grateful Dead still. So.
But so no, it's, this record came out in 1998, which was like when I was in the eighth grade, peak me discovery time, you know. And I don't know, this every time I listen to this record, it's like winter 1998 in my head. So there's that aspect of it. The first time I heard Marilyn Manson was Beautiful People, Big Shiny Tunes 2.
That predates this, right?
Yeah, that's Beautiful People was 96.
Sweet
this
Dreams
came out in 98.
Sweet Dreams
Sweet Dreams predates that, which was like 95.
Big Shiny Tunes 1. Big same record though, isn't it?
No, Sweet Dreams was on Smells Like Children, which was just an EP.
Antichrist Superstar.
Beautiful People was Antichrist. Anyway, I just was kind of like, I knew about Marilyn Manson, and I thought, I knew I really liked Beautiful People. I had listened to Sweet Dreams. I liked that song too. And then this record came out, and I was just floored by how just there's so much packed into this record. Like the music is one thing, but the presentation of it, the ideas around it, all this kind of stuff. It's kind of the same reason I like Scream. It's not just a base level conversation. There's some really deep things to get into with these things that
so
I really like.
Should we segue into that and maybe talk about like there's a concept record about a similar to Ziggy Stardust, and he claims
very
to be
similar.
Very inspired by Ziggy Stardust. I think the concept
sounds like it
probably holds
and the
together.
Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a little. So it's about this alien who comes down to Earth, and there's two people that, and that's the Omega is this
alien.
Yeah.
So there's two characters presented on this album. Omega, who, if you listen to the record, they actually call Omega.
Yeah.
It's just like in a weird little sample thing that happens in one song. And Alpha. And the idea is that there's this dichotomy between these two characters that come to Earth and see just the human race being led astray consistently with things like drugs and celebrity and just this surface culture that presents itself in a lot of Marilyn Manson stuff. He critiques the blind leading the blind kind of culture frequently and across a lot of records.
Okay.
And this one is like no different. This one revolves more around drugs.
And then the Omega character is like this drugged out rock star alien. And then the Alpha character is like this sort of emotionally dead version of Marilyn Manson himself. Is that is from the Wikipedia page?
Yeah, totally. It's supposed to be sort of like Omega is the person who is capable of leading those masses, but is only doing it because he knows they're stupid and will follow. And then Alpha is this character that finds some semblance of humanity in himself and is starting to kind of question why humans are this way and
why they are mechanical animals.
Yeah. Or whether they are, you know.
So
there's a whole host, like that's one reading of this record. And
what are the other ones?
Well, I think these are the ones you'll read on the Wikipedia page and stuff, but
which is what I did.
No, it totally, but and it's part of a larger conversation that happens around Marilyn Manson records, because technically this is it's supposed to be part of a trilogy of albums that actually works chronologically in reverse. So the record that comes out after this is Hollywood. That's meant to be kind of like the first of the trilogy, and then Omega and the Mechanical Animals, and then Antichrist Superstar. So there's like this progression, but it's all kind of talking about the same thing. It talks about celebrity culture. It talks about this idea of people following people for no reason and believing in substance, in believing in like the surface and not the substance.
Follow-up question. Was Marilyn Manson, because basically my entire experience with Marilyn Manson is like a couple music videos when I was a kid, and then his part in Bowling for Columbine where he's super smart, super articulate, mm-hmm. talks about how like blaming the Columbine stuff on him is ludicrous and that like, you know, he's very, very smart guy. Was he always that way in interviews at this time as well, or was he more like aloof and didn't reveal himself to be the like intelligent person that he is?
No, he was pretty articulate. If you watch like Antichrist Superstar era videos, even like pre-Antichrist, he's always very articulate. And the thing that I like most about Marilyn Manson is that everything he does is calculated. He doesn't do anything without thinking about it a ton first. And so when he presents himself, he presents himself as an articulate and intelligent person. And he does that on his records and he does that in his books. And he does.
Where's he from?
He is from
seems very
Orange
Midwestern.
County or something.
Oh,
he's from Florida.
Okay.
No, so, not oh, Orange Florida. County. Sorry. Yeah, he's from Florida.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because he just seems kind of like when you see him in the picture, like Jeff posted with no makeup, he's
yeah,
just like
yeah.
this nerdy, like obviously picked on dude.
He looks actually, as a child, there's one rumor about
oh, yeah,
Marilyn
that rumor.
Manson that he is Paul from the Wonder Years or that, you know, it's the same person. And it's because if you see pictures of him as a kid, you would think that too.
Like,
yeah,
like
he looks exactly
similar.
Like the same guy, but it's not.
That's one of the best rumors.
Yeah.
What are, there's the Pop Rocks rumor.
We the ribs
about
rumor.
The, oh, yeah. That was a Marilyn Manson rumor.
What's
as well.
What's the Pop Rocks rumor?
The Pop Rocks rumor is like if you drink Coke and eat Pop Rocks, it'll like explode
oh.
your head.
So oh,
that's a
no,
that's
I'm
a
just going, I'm going urban legends
urban
kind
legends,
of thing.
Yeah.
And there was the one that like Screech is like Dustin, or Dustin Diamond is Mike D's brother, that like
oh.
Mike D's name is Mike Diamond. They're also a lie. But I like those things. Those are some of my favorite things.
Yeah.
Before the
there's
internet.
There's a ton of them around Marilyn Manson.
What were the other ones besides the ribs and the...
Well, the, like, he was...
I heard the ribs thing about Prince, too.
Oh, yeah. The for those of you who don't know, the rumor is that he had one of his ribs removed to fillet himself,
yeah.
to be able to do that, to be able to have that ability.
Imagine going through that surgery as a rock star
yeah.
because you preferred that to, like, one of the many people who would do that for you.
You just wake up from the hospital bed and you're just like, can I do it now?
yeah. So, so anxious.
Like,
can
I do it right now?
As an adult, that seems like the most preposterous thing I've ever
yeah.
heard. But as a kid, I believed it 100%.
But he got a lot of flack from religious groups, obviously, especially around the Antichrist time, which is when he blew up, mostly having to do with the fact that he used the term Antichrist in his album title and that his kind of music and his appearance were all very scary. And I could talk literally for hours about the Antichrist record.
I do appreciate the fact that Marilyn Manson seems smarter than shock for shock's sake. Like
mm-hmm.
he's shocking, but then has like substance under there that like, if you were listening to his records are like legitimate critiques of like American culture.
And I was listening to this record over the last couple of days, kind of trying to digest it and be ready to talk about it. And there are lots of songs on Mechanical Animals that where he talks about that. Like the lyric to Rock is Dead, which is the chorus, is Rock is Deader Than Dead. The shock is all in your head.
Yeah.
And so he like he uses that. He understands his position as an artist and he intentionally provokes people, but he is also quick to say, you know, it's not, it's just made up. These are all made up things that we're talking about.
Yeah. Should we play a little bit of Rock is Dead and then come back and keep chatting? Was this a
yeah.
single, Rock is Dead?
It was a single. It's also very similar to Beautiful People, if you'll notice. And there's a song on Hollywood that is very similar to this song as well. And that's because it's like supposed to be coherent together.
Okay, well, let's play a little bit of this and then come back and we'll chat about it. So
Love that song.
I definitely, I don't know, maybe I wasn't watching MTV as much at this point in my life, but I do not know any of these songs before we listen to this record.
This is arguably his biggest record.
Yeah, because Dope Song... Dope Show.
I don't like the Dope...
I love the Dope Song.
I love that and, Dope Song, right?
The Dope Song and the Rock is... Rock is dying.
Yeah.
I like the Beautiful People one.
Yeah.
See, that's the only song I think I know now in retrospect.
Well, there was this song. Dope Show was like the first big single. The second single from this record was I Don't Like the Drugs, But the Drugs Like Me. Yeah, that one. Yeah. And then Rock is Dead. And then there's also Coma White, which is the last song on this record, was a single too.
And that has a special significance for what... There was like a website that was Coma White or something?
It was one of the ways they like brought out the... They brought the... They launched the kind of marketing campaign around it. There was a lot of weird subtext around the record when they were doing the launch for it. And when you bought the CD copy, there's like... It came in a blue case. And if you put the album jacket in different ways, you could decode these weird messages that are samples on the record and stuff like that. These are the reasons that I think Marilyn Manson's a genius.
It's pretty smart. It's like the Stanley Kubrick of record making. Everything's deliberate. How do you feel, Jeff?
Yeah, it feels deliberate.
Yeah, it's deliberate.
You don't acquiesce the genius part, though.
No, I mean, this is all very interesting to me. But I don't know if it's going to make me like those tunes
yeah,
anymore.
I think
and that's fine.
I'm on the same page. Like, I definitely had fun listening to this, but I don't ever really need to. Like, I appreciate the thoughtfulness and the deliberateness and that his message is, like, in my opinion, a correct message. Like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? He's, like, asking people to think for themselves and not to, like, buy into, like, Americanized culture and,
yep.
and even think about themselves critically in the context of his music. Like, why do you listen to me? And
yeah.
why do you like...
Why am I the guy?
Yeah. And I think that's all super interesting.
And that's present in this kind of trilogy of records, which is, you know, he does it in different ways, but that's the thing when I was talking about earlier where people will talk about the narratives of these records. I think one thing that often gets missed in this kind of narrative is the fact that he... is talking about himself, obviously. Like, as a songwriter, you're coming from a personal perspective, and people are quick to jump into this idolized way of approaching these records as narrative only, but it's important to recognize that he's critiquing himself as much as he is the culture. I think
that's fair. He's super smart. I don't like Marilyn.
Did you go see him when he came?
I have seen him twice. I saw him in Montreal in 2005 or 6, which was right at the... I think it was the Eat Me, Drink Me tour, which was like one of his newer records. And then I did go see him when he came here, yeah.
Was it good?
Yeah, was it good?
When he performed here, he had like the swine flu.
Oh.
It was like notable that he like was super sick.
Before you... like started finishing that, when you're like, when he performed here, he had the swine flu, and for a second I thought the swine flu was like a backing band that he was notorious for bringing around. And that was
would be a great name,
the musicians on this tour, and that they were like the good band from the early days, so the swine flu shows were the better ones. But
no, his original band was Marilyn Manson and the Spooky Kids.
What was the record that follows this one that's part of the trilogy, that's like the initial part in the chronology?
It's called Hollywood.
And what was the big song off that?
Probably like the Fight Song or the Nobodies.
I don't know how I managed to, like, I know Beautiful People well and nothing else.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just that was what I watched or when it was on MTV.
Yeah, I mean, it also probably has a lot to do with the kind of music you listen to. Like, when I grew up, when I was a teenager, I loved heavy music. Like, yeah. I was listening to this record as well as some very other terrible bands.
Did you hide this from your parents?
No.
Were they worried?
I don't think they were worried, but I do. If you've never seen this record, part of the kind of marketing behind it as well is that these characters that he presents, and this is very much where Bowie comes into play, is he presents these characters in a very androgynous way, but also like in his live performances played up his like femininity, and it was like this is a glam rock record,
yeah,
you know, so they're kind of like speaking to glam rock about it, and the album cover is like him as an alien, but he's got this prosthetic suit on and he has breasts and his genitals are like
bulbous.
Airbrushed out. Yeah, like a Ken doll, you know what I mean? And so I remember my high school girlfriend at the time had a giant poster of this album cover in her room, and her parents were just like, what is going on here?
Would it be fair to say that his mainstream popularity fell off right after this record?
No, I think Hollywood, he still had a lot of punch because Hollywood caused a big stir, also because of the album cover, because the cover is him crucified, like Christ. And some stores refused to
carry this one. Walmart and all of them refused to carry this
and
one.
And so what I hear again is these are the things I like the most about Marilyn Manson is so this album cover comes out. And we're still talking about Hollywood here. And it's a picture of him basically crucified on a cross. His jaw is missing. It's kind of graphic, but not crazy. I can understand, you know, why religious folks would have been upset by it. And so this record gets banned from all the stores. And it's a big deal. It's kind of like a shock rock thing. And he's like, listen, you have a cross in your house with a dude hanging on it. But I can't put this imagery on my album.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, we're talking about violence here. We're talking about violence against other people. And you're like glorifying this violence every single day. And that makes you a better person somehow. And my record cover is not acceptable. How come? You know, like those are the conversations I find most compelling about Marilyn Manson.
Yeah. I agree with that. Well, I think
isn't it? I would feel like it was less with the violence and more with the blasphemy.
Yeah. Well, also that. But like he, I don't know. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be?
Yeah. I think it's more about like him using an image that's like very sacred.
That can no longer be disassociated with Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. But
he's just talking about Romans and the practice of crucifixion generally.
No, but there's a difference between like
classic Jeff.
Yeah. Something being like I think his response to that would be like, why is it blasphemous? You know, if it's the identification of this horrible thing that happened to one person, you know? I think you'd have a lot to say about that.
What happened to Marilyn Manson? Why did, like, how did he fall out? I mean, obviously you can't maintain this kind of shock rock for, like, a career, but was there a specific moment, like, or did his records just sort of dwindle and, like, do less and less well, and fans drop? When did you drop off? Have you bought every Marilyn Manson album?
You know I have.
Okay.
I still, and, you know, he put out a new song yesterday, and I was still excited to buy his records. His new song is very good. It's very much in this vein. It's actually more kind of, like, groovy rock and less heavy metal, which is kind of what he's been tending towards.
He was doing, like, a rap thing for a while, wasn't he?
No. That's not a true
That was
statement.
Only in your dreams, man. That was you.
Maybe
like,
he had a video that was playing on Rap Tropes or something.
Maybe, yeah. I think that was part of maybe one
he
of
was
the
was that wearing like a grill for a while?
Yeah. That was from the Golden Age of Grotesque. Was from that record.
So where do you drop off? I know you own them all, but where do you sort of feel like his creative output was starting to like?
I think the Golden Age of Grotesque was kind of
was
like
2000.
Yeah, that would have been 2001 or 2002.
Okay, so he was good from like 95, 96
to like 2000. That's like peak Manson.
And then it's just, you think this might be a resuscitation?
I think a lot of things happened with him. One of them being he's always had trouble keeping people in his band because he's kind of a notorious jerk.
Okay.
And around the age of the Golden Age of Grotesque, the core of his band kind of started falling away. Twiggy Ramirez, the bass player, was kind of, he's the guy who writes a lot of these songs, or at least did Antichrist and on Mechanical Animals.
So
and so once you lose
suffered.
That linchpin, the songwriting really suffered. I also think he kind of had like three concept-driven records and successful concept-driven records in a row, it's hard to keep that momentum going. Yeah. At a certain point, your concepts are just not going to land, and I think that's what happened with Golden Age of Grotesque. He kind of tried to carry on this thing, but it wasn't as strong, and it didn't really
resonate.
Like
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Three good movies.
We don't need Marilyn Manson, the Clone Wars.
Let's play one last song. We're kind of out of time, and we'll get out of here. What one would you like to let us play out
with? My favorite... I want to say this before we leave. Also, one of the things that I most appreciated about this record is that there's always this assumption that Marilyn Manson is like a heavy music person, and that is definitely true. But even on Antichrist Superstar, there are some of these songs that are really kind of slower and a lot more disconnected from heavy music. They're a little bit more like goth oriented.
There's acoustic guitar.
And on this record, there are tons of acoustic songs, and they are some of my favorites.
So this record is kind of like the
melancholy
of...
Sort of. And you may have read this if you were reading on the Manson Wiki. This record, in its CD form, is like a track listing, but it's not intended to be that track listing. Like, the intended track listing is supposed to be you listen to the Omega record and you listen to the Alpha record. And if you buy the album on vinyl, you do that.
Why
it's a
did
messed
they
up
not sequence
listing.
It correctly?
I honestly don't know. I haven't read anything about that, but...
Because, I saw that the vinyl track listing is different. It's done by, like, character, but...
It was a mistake.
Do you think it was just like the record label was like, this is the sequencing we want?
I think it's a harder sell to put all those slow songs together and put all the rock and roll songs together, because you're probably, if you're just in it for the rock and roll songs, you're probably just going to check out after the first half or something.
So what do you want to play as a segue out of here?
So that being said, one of my favorite Marilyn Manson songs is called Speed of Pain.
Speed of Pain, is it? And it's a slow one.
It's a slow burn.
All right, so let's play Speed of Pain. We're done. You've been listening to 10 Things I Hate About You Too. Thanks, Trevor Murphy, for coming in to talk about Scream and Marilyn Manson.
Stick around for Halifax is Burning.
And you're
you're up next too.
All right, here we go. Speed of Pain.
Wait,
what do you want?
We're not doing.
We're taking a break for 2 weeks because Jeff has to work.
Yeah.